This is Clinical Conversations podcast number 131. Thank you for joining us. We're part of Journal Watch, which tracks new research for working clinicians. Its website is jwatch.org. I'm Joe Elia. Joining me is co-host Dr. Danielle Scherer of the Medical University of South Carolina. The 2006 pentavalent rotavirus vaccine has made a big difference in the lives of young children in the U.S. In this week's New England Journal of Medicine, researchers from the CDC give a broad overview of the vaccine's clinical benefits and cost savings. They looked at data from the pre-vaccine era, 2001 to 2006, and compared that with data from two peak rotavirus seasons during which the vaccine had been widely deployed. For example, during the 2008 season, hospitalizations for rotavirus-related diarrhea dropped by 75%, and for diarrhea of any cause by 33% among children under age 5, whether vaccinated or not, compared to the pre-vaccine era. Evidence that the vaccine itself made a difference may be seen in the fact that in both the 2008 and 2009 rotavirus seasons, hospitalization was some 90% lower for rotavirus among vaccinees versus the unvaccinated. Our guest is a senior author on the report. Dr. Umesh Parashur is with the Division of Viral Diseases in the CDC's Epidemic Intelligence Service. Welcome to Clinical Conversations, Dr. Parashur.
Thank you. My pleasure.
This is an encouraging story. Were you surprised by the magnitude of the benefit?
Yeah, actually, it's a very positive story, and it's a good news for parents, for healthcare providers, and overall our healthcare system. Rotavirus is by far the leading cause of severe gastroenteritis in young children globally. And in the United States, before we had vaccines implemented, we estimated that about 55 to 70,000 children were hospitalized for rotavirus each year, about 200,000 visited an emergency room, and 400,000 visited a doctor's office. So it's a considerable disease burden, and to look at it in another way, these figures mean that 1 in 70 children born each year was hospitalized for rotavirus by age 5, 1 in 20 visited an emergency room, and 1 in 10 a doctor's office. So you can see that the statistics show it's a common severe childhood illness, and the impact of vaccine that was seen in this study was quite dramatic, as you noted the figures, a decline of 60 to 70% in hospitalizations for rotavirus and an overall decline of 30% in all diarrheal hospitalizations. So I think the data clearly show that the vaccines are performing as we had expected based on pre-licensure trials. And I think one thing that is worthwhile noting, which was an unanticipated benefit, was the fact that even in children who had not received vaccine, we saw that rates of severe rotavirus disease and diarrheal illness were lower than what you had seen in pre-vaccine years. And this really suggested that besides protecting vaccinated children, vaccination also reduced circulation of rotavirus in the community, and you benefited unvaccinated children as well, what's called herd immunity. So it's an overall very positive message, impact as we had expected, some unanticipated benefits, and significant, they translate into significant savings in healthcare cost and disease reduction.
And as you mentioned, the reduction in hospitalization rates were very impressive. Tell us a little bit more about the results you found for emergency room and outpatient visits.
Well, I think, again, if you look at rotavirus disease, we know that as you get into disease that's more severe, the fraction that's attributed to rotavirus increases. It is an above-average severity pathogen. So when you look at hospitalizations for rotavirus before vaccines in the U.S., we estimated about 45 to 50% of all diarrhea hospitalizations were caused by rotavirus. If you look at emergency room visits for diarrhea, that percent due to rotavirus is lower at about 30-35%. Mm-hmm. And when you get to doctor's office visits, it gets even lower to 25-30%. Mm-hmm. So you'd expect that if you're looking at overall impact on diarrheal visits to hospitals, emergency rooms, and clinic visits, the overall reduction would be most for hospitalizations because rotavirus accounts for most of the diarrheal hospitalizations, and least for the clinic visits since rotavirus accounts for the smallest fraction of that outcome. And that's indeed what we saw, that the decline in diarrheal hospitalizations was as much as 45 to 58% during the season, but for emergency room visits it was lower, and progressively it was a little bit lower for outpatient visits. Nevertheless, you know, these are all significant impacts that were seen in each outcome.
Mm-hmm. And then there were some temporal trends. It looked like the most benefit that you found was in the 2008 season, but that the rates rebounded a bit in 2009. What were the explanatory variables for that?
Yeah, that's an astute observation, and it's somewhat counterintuitive. You'd think that vaccine coverage, since it was launched in 2006, was increasing, and so you'd expect in 2009, when the vaccine had reached more children, that you would expect greater reduction than in the preceding season. Mm-hmm. But we actually saw the opposite, and it did puzzle us when we initially looked at the data why we were seeing this trend. And there are two interesting observations to note. First, when we looked at data for 2008, which is the first post-vaccine season we evaluated in more detail, we saw that, you know, the disease rates were reduced among children who had been vaccinated and the age groups that were vaccinated, which were essentially less than one-year-old children for this season and a few 1 to 2 year olds. Mm-hmm. But we also saw that in children who were 2 to 4 years old, and this group was largely unvaccinated, we had a big decline in disease, almost as much as directly vaccinated age groups. And this was a suggestion of the phenomenon of herd immunity I alluded to before, mm-hmm. protection in even children who were unvaccinated because of reduced rotavirus transmission. In 2009, the second season that we evaluated, the disease rates in the vaccinated age groups, which for this season had reached up till 2 years of age and a few 2 to 3 year olds, was still maintained very low at levels like 2008. But one noticeable difference relative to 2008 was in the older children in 2009, we did not see such a prominent reduction, and this again were unvaccinated children. Mm-hmm. And we don't have definitive evidence, but at least our working hypothesis is that it's possible that because 2008 was such a low season, there were children who were 2 to 4 years old who were unvaccinated, who also did not get naturally infected and exposed to rotavirus as they typically would during a season. Mm-hmm. And so these susceptibles essentially accumulated in the subsequent year. And when 2009 rotavirus season came about, you had a larger pool of susceptible 2 to 4 year olds, and therefore the season in this age group was much stronger. It's a hypothesis. It's actually something that was suggested by mathematical modeling studies that were done, that you would essentially see some year-to-year variability. So not entirely surprising, but certainly something that was worthwhile to note.
And then there were also some implications by region, in the sense that the Western region appeared not to benefit quite as much. Is that a fair statement?
No, I think that's a fair statement. I would maybe expand that a little bit to say that the West seemed to lag behind the rest of the country by 1 year in a simple way. What you saw was that in the first season, 2008, we actually saw drops that were larger than 2009 in each of the three regions except the West, wherein in the West, the 2009 season was almost like the 2008 seasons in other regions. And again, we don't have, you know, a clear explanation for this, but if we go back to some of the mathematical modeling work I alluded to before, we had done a study before vaccine was introduced where one of the interesting patterns of rotavirus in the U.S. is that in each year, the season first begins in the West. So a rotavirus activity begins in November, December in the Southwest, and then it doesn't actually peak in the Northeast till about 3 or 4 months later. And it's a pattern we've seen for 10, 15 years before vaccines were launched. Mm-hmm. And we were trying to understand what explains the fact that you have this migratory pattern from the Southwest to the Northeast. Mm-hmm. And it isn't explained by any weather phenomenon. We tried to correlate a variety of weather parameters. But one interesting thing was if you look at population birth rates, the western states in the U.S. have the highest birth rates among all U.S. states. So essentially what happens, again, it's a hypothesis, is that in the western states, you're having more births. So after each season, you accumulate susceptible infants faster, and there's a larger number. And so the disease, when it returns the next year, begins in those states. If that's true, then you'd expect that the vaccine coverage would need to be more in these regions to have the same level of impact as in other regions. So it could potentially explain some of the interesting patterns that were seen. I wouldn't say that the West did not experience the benefits. They did. It's just that it appeared to be delayed by 1 year.
And speaking of the mathematics of all this, Dr. Parisher, you estimated on the basis of the number of visits avoided and hospitalizations avoided from your numbers that the cost savings to the system was something on the order of $275 million over, a 2 year period?
That's right.
And you say that you did not factor into that the cost of the vaccine program. So,
correct.
But at any rate, I get the sense that you're going to be examining some of these hypotheses that you've mentioned in the course of the conversation, and that there'll probably be somebody with a ledger looking at the absolute cost savings over time.
Yeah, I think you're right. There are several issues that are not fully addressed in this analysis. One is what you pointed out, that if you look at costs, all we've measured is a reduction in treatment costs for hospitalizations. Mm-hmm. So we haven't really even measured the treatment costs saved for emergency department visits, outpatient visits, and the many episodes of diarrhea that occur at home, which don't require a doctor's visit, including indirect costs such as the loss of parents' time when they have to take time off work to care for a child at home. So there's a variety of cost savings that are not measured, and also, as you pointed out, on the other side of the equation, we haven't measured the cost of the vaccine program either. So a more formal and complete cost-benefit analysis does indeed need to be done and is one of the future areas to look at. The other thing, as we talked about, there were some patterns in regional variations and differences in indirect effects that we saw in the two seasons that do require additional monitoring. Finally, I think there's this evaluation largely looked at 2008-2009, when we predominantly had the pentavalent vaccine in use. There is a second vaccine, the monovalent vaccine, launched in June of 2008, and in future season data beyond these would let us also look at impact and effectiveness of that vaccine as well.
There is a small low rate of intussusception, which has always been something that's concerning to some parents with these vaccines. How might clinicians deal with those fears when asked by a parent about the risk of intussusception?
Well, I think the best way to deal with it is really to present the information in an easy, understandable form and in facts and figures to the extent possible. I would point out that the data that we have on risk with these current vaccines is largely from international settings, from evaluations done in Latin America, specifically in Mexico, Brazil, and some data from Australia. We do not have a documented risk from post-licensure monitoring in the U.S. That being said, I think we don't have enough data from the U.S. to exclude a risk of the magnitude seen in other settings. And if you look at the magnitude of the risk seen in other settings, it's approximately 1 to 2 cases per 100,000 vaccinated infants. That's about 5 to 10-fold lower than what was seen with an earlier vaccine that was withdrawn from the market about a decade ago. Mm-hmm. It's a lower magnitude risk. We also have looked at, you know, if you look at the risk-benefit scenario from this analysis alone, you can see that the vaccine is preventing as many as 30, 40,000 hospitalizations for diarrhea each year. And you would potentially, with that level of intussusception risk and full immunization of the U.S. cohort, see an excess of 50 to 60 intussusception hospitalizations. So the figures, to some extent, speak for themselves, you know, preventing 30 to 40,000 hospitalizations from diarrhea versus an excess 50 to 60 intussusception hospitalizations.
Mm-hmm. All right, Dr. Parisher. This has been enlightening, and we look forward to further results on this vaccine. We hope we'll have you back again. Thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you for the chance to discuss.
Thank you.
That was our 131st. Earlier podcasts are available at podcasts.jwatch.org. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Ador Yano. I'm Joe Elia. Join us next time. For myself and Dr. Danielle Scherer, thank you for listening.